Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Hey, you're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I am here with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad in the studio.
Hello.
Hey, man. Hi. So this is our midweek podcast drop where we're going to listen to a story from last week's show. The theme last week was Folly of Youth, and this piece, I think, is probably what gave us the idea for that theme. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. And this would definitely qualify as a folly.
Youthful folly?
Yeah, maybe folly's too polite of a word since we're going to be talking about murder.
So let's have a listen to this story from Sound Effect on KNKX. In the picture, Herbert Nichols Jr. looks even younger than his 12 years. His hair is parted down the middle, his ears stick out a little, and he has just a hint of a guileless little smile. And around his neck is a placard that says 13973, Herbert Nichols, prison number. Now, we know a kid's behavior has a lot to do with the kind of parenting he got. But back in the 1930s, a child like the one in this mugshot would likely just end up being labeled a bad kid. Federal Way author Nancy Bartley wrote the book on Herbert Nichols Jr., and she shared his story with us.
Herbert Nichols was 12 years old. He weighed 60 pounds. He was malnourished, and he lived with his abusive grandmother in Asotin, Washington, down on the Snake River. And this is 1931. He had run away from home one night, and it was shortly before midnight because he was hungry. He decides to break into the general store to get something to eat. While in the process of filling a sack with candy and gum and cigarettes and various things, he was surprised in the act by Sheriff John Wormill. Herbert had a stolen handgun with him, and he hid behind the vinegar barrel. Wormill walked slowly through the store, shouting for Herbert to come out. And Herbert, being 12 and not necessarily thinking, maturely, figures that if he just jumps up and fires a gun, Wormill is going to run away, and then Herbert's going to go out the back door and run up the hill and hightail it to Canada, where he's going to be a trapper. Well, it didn't quite work that way. He jumped up and he fired, but Wormill was quite close, and the bullet struck Wormill in the head and killed him. The rest was, of course, that Herbert's immediately arrested. He's put into a one-room cell in Asotin. And he is destined for prison.
So let's rewind the tape a little bit and talk about who Herbert is. How did he wind up in that position?
Well, Herbert was from a very poor family. They lived in Star, Idaho. They had 9 kids total, and his father was mentally ill. His mother was incredibly poor. She was trying to support the children. And this was in the middle of the Depression. The father had shot and killed a neighbor woman and was sent to the state mental institute at Orofino. But afterwards, there was no one left to like hunt or fish or to feed the family, and she had to give away all her children to various foster homes and relatives to see that the children, wouldn't starve. So Herbert went to his paternal grandmother in Asotin, and that's where, he ran into far more trouble than he'd been into before.
How did that play out there?
It did not play out well because she was a religious zealot. She believed he was possessed by the devil, and she could just whip him for any infraction, and she would starve him, and that's why at 12 he was only 60 pounds. When they put him in the one-room cell in Asotin, he was at risk of being hanged, and they had to move him.
You mean like lynched?
Yeah. He was at risk of being lynched by the people who lived in the area because they were so angry. So they had, for safekeeping, they had to move him to Pomeroy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what happened next, and how did the justice system handle this really unusual case?
Well, first of all, the way the law was set up at the time, there were juvenile facilities, But they were set up for what was called status offenders. And they were people who like ran away from home, kids who may have been abandoned or whatever. And they weren't set up for violent offenders. So Herbert could not go into the juvenile justice system because he was a violent offender. And they had rules that you can't put murderers in with, you know, the juvenile system. And on the other hand, the state penitentiary couldn't quite get used to the idea of someone that young committing a murder. So he was sort of in between. What do you do with very young people who do really awful things and really hurt people? In Herbert's case, the state decided that they were going to put him in the adult penitentiary at Walla Walla, and that's where they went.
So what ultimately was he sentenced to?
He was sentenced to life, but he ended up getting out when he was 21. So he served about 9 years.
So what was Herbert's life like in Walla Walla prison?
He was able to be removed from the majority of the prison population. Eventually, they built him this little shack out underneath one of the guard towers so he could actually live by himself in this little shack. And then he did trustee work, which means the higher level functioning prisoners can go and like work. Like he worked at the warden's mansion quite a bit, and the warden really, Warden McCauley, really mentored him. Because he was a likable kid. He wanted to be loved. He wanted all these things that are normal for children to want. He ate his meals with officers.
Not with the other inmates.
You know, he ate his meals with either trustees. He became a student at the local high school, even though he couldn't leave the prison. The superintendent would come in and give him lessons, you know, say, this is what you have to do this week. You know, and he delivered to the prison library, and then the prison librarian would mentor him. And then along with two of kind of the well-educated inmates, one was a literary agent, James Ash, and the other was a doctor who was in trouble there, Peter Miller. He ended up being a very good mentor.
So all the he got in prison all the guidance and mentorship and role models that he never got in his own family.
Exactly, yeah. Eventually, another governor came in. It's Governor Martin came in, and he took interest and then was able to parole Herbert.
So when he was released, how did it go? How did he integrate back into society?
Okay, well, when Governor Martin decided to release him, Martin got involved and said, let's try this. Let's go on down to Tacoma Boat. And so he got him a job in the accounting department, and he thrived. You know, he was working with numbers, and he had responsibility, and he was using his brain because he was very bright. And while there, he got to know people with, I think it was the RAND Corporation, and they put him in touch with people at 20th Century Fox and said, Fox is hiring. And you know, and the next thing you know, he's down in Hollywood. But the most important thing is he stayed crime-free. He married, you know, he became a father, you know, he was a citizen.
Yeah. This feels like a kind of nature versus nurture, natural experiment in some ways. And those were concepts that were actively debated in the middle of the century, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So how did Herbert's life end?
He had been, of course, mingling with celebrities through 20th Century Fox and living a pretty good life. But he was always afraid that his past, you know, would be found out because he'd kept it secret. His wife knew, but his son didn't. And one of his investments that he had entered into with Pat Boone had gone sideways, and someone, you know, who had also invested in like a, it sounded like kind of a pyramid scheme or something, he had filed a civil suit against Pat Boone and other people who had kind of organized this business. And Herbert was just irrationally frightened of the idea that this might go to court, and who he was, his whole life, early life as a 12-year-old in prison was going to be discovered. And he figured that that was the trigger that would send him back to prison. He had had heart issues, and he was in his early 60s, and he basically stopped taking his heart medication. And then one night, you know, he was in pain, and his son found him in horrible pain, and he'd had a massive heart attack, and he died.
And the thinking truly is that he did that on purpose because he was avoiding going to court?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Confronting his past?
Yeah, he was absolutely afraid of going back to prison.
What do you make of an ending like that to this story?
I think it's tragic. It's totally tragic. I think Herbert's story is tragic.
It just seems so, I mean, maybe tragic's the word, or just bitterly ironic that he, against all odds, transcended this horrible beginning that he had and this horrible act he had committed and seemed to have beat it. And then it kind of came back to bite him in the very end and ended his life.
Yeah, in some ways it is. The sad thing was that what carried with him in his heart was the trauma that was never, ever healed. One thing I will tell you, that after the book came out, and then I heard from the sheriff's grandson, and he had gone to Vietnam, and he had been a prisoner of war, and with a lot of time to think about a whole lot of things, and he thought about Herbert Nichols while he was in a camp, and he decided that he was going to come, when he got out of being a POW, that he was going to go to Los Angeles, because he found him in Los Angeles, and thought, I'm going to go kill him. So he shows up one day at his door, and he knocks on Herbert's door, and this is like in, you know, the 70s, and knocks on the door and said, I'm John Wormell's grandson. And Herbert went white, but he invited him in. And the two men talked and talked for several hours. You know, and Herbert told him, you know, how terrified he was in prison. And then Herbert ended up driving him to the airport. And they made peace.
Wow.
Yeah.
So looking back on this, what do you think the lessons are for how society handles kids who commit crimes?
The lessons clearly are is that children do not belong in prisons. Children need to be dealt with at a young age, you know, removed from toxic environments and treated as what they are, kids, still malleable, still capable of change, you know, and not by bureaucrats who are going to sit there and make judgments like they did with Herbert, that he would always be a felon, he would always be worthless, he would always be a menace to society. You cannot tell that about a person. You can't. I mean, my own son was 12 years old when I was writing this and when I was researching this. And one day I was over at the museum in Asotin, and I was reading through all these court documents, and they had just left me alone in the museum, and I'm looking through the kind of dusty glass, and my son is outside riding the same streets that Herbert Nichols used to play in, and I'm watching my son on his bike, and he's riding over mounds of dirt and making motor noises and playing, and I'm thinking, he is just a kid. He's just so little. And I thought, I could not imagine him being in the one room cell next door because he shot someone. You know, I just can't fathom that. It's just cruel and inhuman to think that you could have kids that age and hold them responsible.
Nancy Bartley is a Seattle writer, and her book is called The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols, Jr. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And we're back in the studio with Gabriel Spitzer and producer Kevin Kniestad. Kevin, what sort of has stuck with you about this story since we produced it?
I think that one of the things I sort of take away, this isn't a funny story under any circumstances, but I thought about myself at 12 a lot, and I think it's easy to just kind of look at this as a story and be sympathetic for this kid, but when you really think about yourself at 12, and I mean, there's no age I can sit there and say to you, well, that would be a good age for me to find myself in a maximum security prison, but then I think of Kevin at 12, and it becomes so terrifying. And these prisons, especially back in the 30s, it was tough. And to think of a 12-year-old or think of my 12-year-old self there, the fact that not only he made it through this, but he made it through it better off is kind of mind-blowing to me.
Well, he remarkably lucky to have run into some enlightened adults, and
yeah.
not something that one could count on, right? You know, I mean, yeah. he really hit the lottery as far as his warden and his caregivers go when he was in prison. But you're right. I mean, just the contrast, this is full sort of Shawshank territory here. And if you can imagine a prepubescent kid, and if you have a moment, go to KNKXsoundeffect.org and look at his mugshot, because he really looks, I mean, he looks like he's 10.
Yeah. And it's also kind of mind-blowing to me that this hadn't come up before, this sort of where do we put this kid sort of thing. I mean, certainly a 12-year-old shooting someone doesn't happen all the time, but you think that there would have been some thought process at some point, like, okay, so, you know, the kid jail or the adult jail, let's sort of have this figured out. But there wasn't, and they sort of made this decision on the fly. It's like, okay, we can't put him in the kid jail, so I guess we have to put him in the grown-up prison?
Yeah, those are the only two choices.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the interesting pieces of this interview that didn't make it into the story was talking about a little bit about Nancy Bartley doing her research and finding relatives mm-hmm. of young Herbert, who was no longer young. And she told this anecdote that wound up on the cutting room floor, but I'm glad we're going to get a chance to play it for folks now. You want to sort of set it up?
She mentioned in the story that Herbert's son did not know. In fact, almost no one knew except his wife. So when she was doing her research, she ended up going in meeting Herbert's son. And I think I'll just kind of let her take it from there.
Well, that was something that I was totally unprepared for. Because I went down, I had written a couple times, I tried my phone, I couldn't reach anyone. Finally, I decided, well, I'm going to go down to Los Angeles and I'm just going to knock on the door like a reporter would. And I went down there and his son opened the door and I said, hi, you know, I'm doing this book, and can I talk to you about your dad? Well, he thought I was going to, I guess, talk about, you know, his various things about 20th Century Fox. So, of course, I started out, you know, the real easy questions. You kind of circle around, and finally I said, can you tell me about the time your dad lived in Washington? And he says, oh, my dad never lived in Washington. And then I looked at him kind of like, huh? And I said, well, of course he lived in Washington. You know the trouble he got into. And what trouble? So he says, well, what did he do? And I kind of took one large breath and figuring any minute now I'm going to be kicked out of the house. And so I said, he shot the sheriff, but not the deputy.
You really said that?
I did.
What timing?
I know. And then he kind of looked astounded. And finally he says, well, that explains a lot. Because at one point, he, as a kid, had, and kids do ask parents really random things, he'd asked his dad, Dad, have you ever been in jail? And his dad just looked at him and kind of scowled and said, I don't want to talk about it. And the case closed. And so he never asked his dad again, but he always wondered. But then his son actually started piecing things together, and he told me that there were times when he knew that his dad, like if his dad got into a couple, I guess, altercations, like just traffic altercations, if he had like bumped into somebody, rather than risk any kind of interaction with police, he would just pay someone off. Oh, I bumped your car. Oh, here's money, take money. So he was really had just a terror of authority. I mean, he was very law-abiding, but terror of it was somehow going to, you know, he was going to be returned to prison.
Wow. And just as a biographer, what was it like to realize that you were breaking the news to his son and then watch him making these connections?
Oh, it was absolutely profound moment. And I felt, I wanted to be sure his son was okay, you know, and he was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you imagine putting yourself in the son's shoes for a moment there? It's pretty.
No, as I mentioned before, this is one of those things where you put yourself in these shoes. It's pretty mind-blowing to think about how I might have reacted or you might have reacted if, you know, if someone knocks on your door and says, hey, by the way, here's a part of your dad's life that you had absolutely no idea about. And it was a huge deal.
Yeah. I mean, this is it's interesting. The subtitle of Nancy Bartley's book is The Redemption of Herbert Nichols Jr. And it really is a story of redemption. But I think in the anecdotes like that one, and of course, in the one that came at the end of his life, you get the sense that he really was traumatized. Even in the best of circumstances as far as like incarcerating a kid. He was deeply, deeply traumatized by it, and that seems to have lasted his entire life. And of course, you know, let us not forget in our focus on Herbert Nichols that there's also a man who died in the course of just doing his job, which is also absolutely tragic.
Yeah, I think that it's easy to talk about best case scenarios here and that a lot of them sort of happened. But, you know, I think about the anxiety he must have had to live with every single day and how he was so concerned about constantly being so careful and keeping his secret to himself because he had this massive fear of going back and having to relive what he went through as a kid. The scars were still there. You know, even though he did come out perhaps a better person than he ever would have living the childhood that he had had prior to this tragic event happening, going through the process, knowing that you killed someone, and then being put in this adult prison and going through the process of the trial and everything like that, even as successful as he might have been after he got out of jail, these scars were still overwhelming.
Yeah. We can get to the whole show on Folly of Youth at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org, or of course, check your feed from Saturday. We'll be back this coming weekend when the theme is Money Talks. I'm Gabriel Spitzer here for Kevin Kniestad and the Sound Effect crew. Thanks a lot.